music and talk radio about all things all genders. This is Intravenous, live on CJSF 90.1 FM, discussing and approaching contemporary gender issues through a feminist lens. Our goal is to educate, engage, and challenge the dominant hegemony.
Welcome to Intravenous. My name is Robin. I'm your host for today's program. And as always, Intravenous is coming to you from CJSF 90.1 FM, campus and community radio from Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast on the unceded lands of the Kwikwetlem, the Musqueam, the Squamish, and the Tsleil-Waututh peoples. And I have a really great show for you today. Amanda Aziz is my guest, and she joins me to talk about women's and non-gender conforming folks' access to justice. Amanda practices immigration and refugee law and splits her time between Vancouver and Ottawa, where she joins me through the miracle of technology. Hello, Amanda.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining me on a little bit of a short notice conversation. We've been kind of texting back and forth about doing this and nailed down that this is a good time. So I'll just let listeners know that we are pre-recording this conversation on Tuesday due to a work conflict. You had to join me live via social media, but nevertheless, we'll have a great conversation.
Yeah. One thing I should add maybe before we get into our conversation, just to add to the land acknowledgements, I am actually in Ottawa right now, which is also unceded territory of the Algonquin Anishinaabe people. So there are lots of different unceded territories upon whose land we're on. And I just wanted to acknowledge that that's where I'm calling you from.
Yeah, and especially in relation to the fact that we're talking about rights and human rights and access to the law and what that means for certain folks and how it is supposed to be equitable, but sometimes it doesn't play out in quite the same way.
Indeed.
Part of my wanting to have this conversation is that for the last week and a half or so, it has been the 16 days of activism against gender-based violence, and Thursday, December the 10th, marks International Human Rights Day. And so I thought that you and I would have a conversation about what the relationship between human rights and gender-based violence is and how it pertains to the work that you do.
Yeah, that sounds excellent. And like huge questions and a huge topic for sure.
Yeah. Do you want to start by just giving us sort of your perspective on where those two things intersect?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think it is, I've been thinking, you know, you and I chatted very briefly earlier today, and I've been sort of putting my mind to where to even start with this kind of question. because it is such a big question. And I think, there's so many different lenses through which to think about it. My brain as a lawyer obviously thinks about it in the context of the sort of human rights framework within our legal system, and also the migration, refugee and migration work that I do. And how, you know, the issues of gender-based violence and human rights interplay within that work. And then I think I, you know, also just thinking about it as is it helpful for us to be framing things through a sort of strictly human rights lens, or, you know, how do we contemplate all these bigger picture issues when there's so many intersecting issues at play? But I mean, ultimately, I guess from a very broad, or what's the word I'm looking for, like a sort of higher up viewpoint, a bird's eye view. I mean, ultimately for me, when I think about gender-based violence and some of the issues that I work, or some of the issues that I see at work, you know, the issue of gender-based violence, I guess for me, is one of the ways in which human rights is violated. So the human rights of whatever person is being exposed, or who is at the sort of brunt of that gender-based violence or gender-based harassment or whatever the case may be, ultimately is having their human rights violated. And, you know, I think that violation can be defined in many different ways. There are UN conventions dealing with the right to, you know, the right to life, the right to safety, the right to freedom from sort of cruel and unusual punishment and torture. And I think sort of on the very basic level, I think it also impacts just this idea of sort of access to justice too for me, and how, you know, once there is some incidents of violence, then what happens after the fact, right? So not only are, I think, people's rights being violated at the time of some kind of act against them, but also in the aftermath, what happens when you want to, or when you're trying to, you know, deal with getting access to justice for whatever that violence has been perpetrated against you. Sorry, that wasn't the most coherent answer. But yeah, I mean, it's a big question, I think.
It is a big question, and it deserves a big answer that is as complex and intersectional as you said. You know, like there's a bunch of different things that come together and I think both work together but also clash,
right,
in how it actually manifests itself in terms of what the law is and how the law is practiced. One of the things that I read in preparing for this conversation kind of points to this a little bit. The UN Office of the High Commission states, "Framing gender-based violence against women as a human rights violation implies an important conceptual shift. It means recognizing that women are not exposed to violence by accident or because of an inborn vulnerability. Instead, violence is the result of structural, deep-rooted discrimination, which the state has an obligation to address. Preventing and addressing gender-based violence against women is therefore not a charitable act. It is a legal and moral obligation requiring legislative, administrative, and institutional measures and reforms, and the eradication of gender stereotypes which condone or perpetuate gender-based violence against women and underpin the structural inequities of women with men." That's very wordy. But I think, you know, that statement points to the ways in which what you do as a lawyer comes up against our cultural sort of ways and practices and understandings of how the law gets built and how it gets practiced. And how do you think that we're doing with that in Canada and in British Columbia?
Yeah, I mean, I think those are very important questions. And I think, again, you know, it really, I think there are so many different layers to even just thinking about who we're talking about. my work is primarily with, you know, with those who have immigrated to Canada or are trying to immigrate to Canada, with refugee claimants, with migrant workers. And from my perspective, like, I do think that we have a really long way to go in terms of, you know, recognizing the sort of systems that perpetuate the gender-based violence against women refugee claimants, for example, girls, and also against migrant workers. I think, you know, there is a lot of, or I shouldn't say, I guess there are just lots of different kind of layers in terms of the vulnerabilities and the exploitation. I think that, that, you know, predominantly often women or young girls face. And although I do think, you know, in the sort of broader context of our discussions around, you know, gender violence or gender-based violence being recognized as, you know, harming the human rights of a woman or a girl or whatever the case may be. I know, of course, others can also face gender-based violence. You know, I think that in the context of the work that I do, I think there is still quite a ways to go. And I think in the context of, for example, a lot of the migrant workers that I work with at the Migrant Workers Center, a number of them have come to Canada as, for example, caregivers, who are predominantly women, and who have come to care for, you know, the children or the elderly of Canadian families, and who face very, very precarious working conditions because of the way in which our immigration system is structured. So, you know, we often tie workers, migrant workers in Canada, to their employers and don't allow these workers to work for other employers. And, you know, in the sort of, in the more or in the less vulnerable context of the workforce, right, being a Canadian citizen or even a permanent resident, you know, there's already such a power imbalance between an employer and a worker. There's already like a huge disadvantage to being a woman in the workforce. You know, so then I think adding on another layer of a person's immigration status to that just sort of exacerbates the vulnerabilities even more. And I would say in the context of how we're doing recognizing that as a country, that we're not doing well. We're not doing enough, and people are in very, very precarious situations when it comes to just, you know, the sort of like basic rights that one would expect in a country such as Canada. I also, like, I can't help but think, even just within this pandemic, contemplating, even, you know, outside of my work, but just thinking about like housing security, for example, or the huge increase that we've heard of from social service agencies suggesting that, like, you know, women are particularly vulnerable during this time where everyone's being told to stay at home. You know, and yet we recognize that violence against women and girls is a violation of rights, and you know that as a country, I think you'll hear the Trudeau government talking a lot about their commitment to human rights and their commitment to you know, women and equality, and yet, you know, here we are hearing all these stories of the increase of violence against women during this pandemic, and then the lack of places for people to go, right? That what happens when we don't have that social safety net in the same way that we're used to. Sorry, I have so many.
Yeah.
And then I'm thinking about the welfare state, but yeah, I think, you know, nationally, I feel like we have a big problem still. And sorry, it also just made me think too of, like, you know, I know it's not specifically just about women and girls or just about gender-based violence, but like the fact that I think there are places where there's no, you know, just the fact that there's these First Nations who are being forced off their own land because of unsafe drinking water. I was just thinking about, you know, hearing about or seeing the way that that sort of impacts a whole community. But of course, you know, I think often a lot of these kinds of circumstances disproportionately impact women and girls. So I think we have a long way to go. Federally.
Yeah. Yeah, I do too, which is unfortunate, of course. Yeah. What kinds of things can the public do to put pressure on the government or the legislators to sort of mobilize these issues?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think it always pains me to even just think about how difficult it is for organizations that are doing direct support work, you know, supporting women and girls fleeing violence, supporting people without status, supporting migrant workers, just the amount of work it is to just even be properly funded, right? To get enough funding to do the support work, to be providing resources for those that need assistance. I mean, I think also from my perspective as a lawyer, there is a huge challenge in terms of just access to justice also, and who has access to, as I was saying at the beginning, like who has access to any of these mechanisms by which someone in theory can make a complaint about the sexual harassment that they're facing at work, or who can make a complaint about, you know, not being paid the same as their coworker, or whatever it might be. You know, the sort of burden is always on the complainant making that complaint. And often you're up against employers who have lots of resources and lawyers that they have money to pay. And in the meantime, I think, you know, we have a legal aid system, which, you know, has received, I think, a bit more funding recently with respect to, you know, some sort of public interest in trying to create a bit more access to justice among those who are not able to afford a lawyer. But I think, you know, that ultimately is a huge, huge issue in terms of just, I don't know, pushing some of these issues forward in terms of like the law, in terms of employers knowing how they should be or what, you know, they cannot actually get away with in their places of work. Sorry, I'm talking about this as if it's only, you know, of course, I think the bigger picture issues around having these conversations and preventing the kinds of rights violations in the first place would be ideal. But I'm a bit pessimistic considering the work that I do, that, you know, knowing that ultimately we always will need some kind of recourse or access to these sort of recourse mechanisms in terms of what happens when somebody's rights have been violated.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, it's one step at a time, right?
Right.
We have to go gently into the night, or whatever that adium is, can't change everything in one fell swoop, which is really too bad.
Yeah. One thing I might say, sorry, just about, because I think in the provincial context, I do have some hope with respect to some of the recent changes around the BC Human Rights Commission. So, you know, the previous Liberal government got rid of the BC Human Rights Commission, and the NDP has brought it back, which is excellent. And, you know, I think it can and will be a very powerful office to be doing the work that or doing the sort of research and investigations that are needed to support pushing the conversation and pushing the envelope with respect to human rights and with respect to, you know, discrimination and gender-based violence in the province, and identifying trends and areas in which we need to be you know, we need to be pushing and changing. And so that, I think, was a very positive development in BC recently, and something that a lot of people that are doing work in the sort of broader umbrella of social justice and human rights work, I think we're very pleased to see. So that's, I think, one, you know, positive thing that is happening in BC for sure recently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wasn't aware that the Liberal government had slashed and dashed the Human Rights Commission here. I guess, you know, in my naivete, I just trust that it's something that we would have because it's a good thing to have.
Yeah. Yes.
You know?
Yeah, I know. It seems naive, but also it's like, oh yeah, unfortunately. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. That kind of brings me to the next question that I have, which is also kind of a wordy and big question. But, you know, understanding that men and women, and I say men and women because that's the binary that the law was sort of written with the perspective of having, that men and women would claim equal access to justice under the law. However, and this is something that you already alluded to, men and women don't have equal access to the public sphere, especially in some countries where, unlike Canada, there is, you know, quite a binary between men's roles and women's roles and those kinds of things. And that most persistent violations of women's rights to life, liberty, security of their personhood occur in the private sphere. And so there's this real discrepancy about the law existing in the public sphere, but with women's access to the public sphere being definitely not equal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that I think is something that's very, very present in the work that I do with respect to refugee claimants. I think something that a lot of refugee lawyers have been sort of trying to push back on in terms of decision-making in Canada. Although I think, you know, the refugee determination system in Canada does recognize, gender-based persecution. We do, as opposed to the United States, which under the current and hopefully soon ending administration has really reversed a lot of the protections and the determinations with respect to gender-based violence in the US. Canada does still recognize violence against women and gender-based violence as a form of persecution. But it is interesting, the question that you raise is something that is quite prevalent with respect to determining what happens in, for example, a woman's country of origin, and whether or not she, for example, has access to state protection. So one of the big concepts with regard to refugee determination is this idea that, you know, in addition to putting forward and proving the persecution that you face and the fear that you face and as part of the reason for having to have fled your country, the refugee board also has to contemplate these issues around state protection, whether or not your country can protect you. And this other concept called an internal flight alternative. So if, you know, you're being persecuted in your city, is there another place that you can move to in your country where you won't be persecuted? Which I think by itself is also a big, and a huge issue, I think, that that is disproportionately impacted by, for example, women and men, or those, you know, who are in positions of power in a country. I think this is a very important point through which we need to be pushing around a gender-based or a gendered lens, because exactly as you said. And I mean, Canada's not immune to this either, frankly, right? That this idea that we have these state systems, these policing systems set up across our country, and in whatever else other country, I deal with this a lot with refugee claimants from Central American countries, for example, where a woman is fleeing some kind of persecution, and whether that be from her own family, within her own family, from her spouse, or from the like local gang or whatever it might be that controls her neighborhood, that person, you know, her ability to access what we call state protection is very different than often, you know, her spouse's ability to access state protection. And often it's the case that women that I'm representing won't have ever even thought about reporting a, you know, a rape or a sexual assault to the police, because it, you know, not only is it often dangerous to involve the police because the police can be involved in that kind of persecution as well, but in many cases, there is very little concern with respect to that kind of gender-based or sexualized violence against a woman, that there are, you know, that these acts are committed with impunity in many, many countries. And I mean, unfortunately, I think Canada, I think, is, you know, of course we have laws, and I don't practice in the area of criminal law or, you know, and I don't really do a lot with respect to representing women or girls who are have been involved with the criminal justice system in Canada. But I mean, we are not immune to that problem either, right? I think we also have, I think there is also a real problem with respect to access to even our own public sphere and access to justice, depending on your gender and certainly depending on your race and depending on, you know, your socioeconomic status, right? Like there, I think that's unfortunately not, and maybe I shouldn't say unfortunately, but it's certainly not just an issue that faces other countries. It is, you know, prevalent in Canada as well. But yeah, anyways, full circle, it is, I think, that issue, something that is very alive in the work that I do, just in terms of thinking about, yeah, you know, if you have a refugee claimant, or if I'm helping a refugee claimant from Mexico and they're facing some kind of violence, but they're a man, you know, often it is the case that the men are going to the police more than women are, because the access to so-called state protection is it can be very different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it reminds me of a story closer to home here. In a before life, I used to have a lot of interaction with some First Nations in Manitoba, and there was one woman who I got to know quite well. And every time she and I were alone in the van together, she would tell me horror stories about how she was, you know, quite beaten up by her boyfriend. But because he was the son of the chief or somebody on band council, she had no jurisdiction to report anything to her community, because, you know, there was no status there, you know? And so again, I think the relationship between, you know, some of these refugee claimants coming from especially gang cultures, you know, it's kind of the same, where, you know, there's so much infiltration within the community that there is nowhere to turn except for outside of your country for assistance and for help, especially when it comes to that kind of private space violence.
I mean, I think too, just even thinking about, you know, the sort of access to even just protection in Canada, when I think about police and, you know, you talk to different communities about their access to the police and feeling as if they can access protection from the police. And you'll get majorly different answers depending on, you know, what a person's, from what which community a person comes from, right? I mean, and I think it makes me feel like, despite all the rhetoric with regard to women's rights being human rights, and, you know, I think a lot more awareness with respect to gender identity and expression, and you know, a lot of people doing super important work trying to push, push the envelope with respect to recognition of all these different rights and human, you know, just like basic human rights when it comes to gender identity expression. It's hard not to feel pessimistic, actually, even in our country, when you think about, just what happens and how to just access justice when you're, you know, the family of, the family of like an Indigenous woman who's had their baby taken away or not received healthcare in a hospital because of horrifying acts of discrimination and stereotyping. And I just think, you know, it makes me feel pessimistic. I think I'm also in that sort of COVID 9 month
feeling pessimistic anyways.
Generally, what will the next 6 months bring? But
yeah. I want to remind listeners that they're listening to Intravenous here on CJSF 90.1 FM Campus Community Radio from Simon Fraser University on the unceded territory of the Coquitlam, the Musqueam, the Squamish, and the Tsleil-Waututh people. My guest in the studio, my guest over technology is Amanda Aziz, a practicing immigration and refugee lawyer. And I think we'll take a small pause and hear a song called New Humanity from Los Retros. And we're going to come back and talk a little bit about the new gender reform that is happening in the law or what's being proposed. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
Thank you. FemConquest, CJSF's first program devoted entirely to playing FemCon. Short for female content, FemCon is music written, composed, and/or performed by primarily female-identified people. FemConquest aims to bring attention to women in music who are often underrepresented in all music genres. FemConquest every Friday from 2 to 3 p.m.
This is Free Voices at CJSF 90.1 FM talking to you about
Eagle Nation Universal Production Society. We are 10 board of directors and we are rejoicing for world history. Our show is based on true stories, musical and storytelling and role playing. Silent Crimes Broken, very interesting series of show.
And a lot of in-depth oral tradition. We play every Thursday from 3 to 4. Come and join us.
And welcome back. That was New Humanity from the band Los Retros. And I'm Robin. This is Intravenous. My guest is Amanda Aziz, and we've been talking about the law and how it is not equally accessible to everybody in Canada and across the world in the ways that it claims. And in the ways that it needs to, in order for people to really have their human rights protected and held up. And one of the things that might be encouraging in this conversation, because it seems like there's a lot to be pessimistic about with so much change needed. But there's currently a review or some initiative to look at new gender guidelines for law practice in BC or Canada.
It's in front of the Immigration and Refugee Board. So with respect to immigration and refugee determinations.
Yeah. So What would that shift? How would that make a difference in what you see?
Mm-hmm. The review is happening at the Immigration and Refugee Board of what they're calling their gender guidelines. So the Immigration and Refugee Board is the national administrative tribunal that adjudicates all sorts of issues relating to our immigration and refugee system. It is it contains one division, the Refugee Protection Division, and then it's sort of related appeal division. Those divisions make up Canada's refugee determination system. So, you know, if you are in Canada and making a claim for refugee protection inside of our country, it's being heard by that division. And part of what this board has created are a set of guidelines for those who are making decisions. It is an independent quasi-tribunal or quasi-legal, independent tribunal. So quasi-judicial tribunal is what I meant to say. And there are a number of guidelines to help guide these independent decision makers in making their decisions when a certain, type of claim is before them. So there are guidelines related to, you know, when a person is coming from a situation of civil war in their country, and guidelines related to child refugee claimants. And then the one that specifically is getting a review right now is related to women refugee claimants. And, you know, I think the board has been quite focused on reviewing, I think, processes and guidelines when it comes to adjudicating claims based on gender-based persecution. And I mean, I think it's a very important time for the board to be doing this. I mean, it should have been done a long time ago, but there are unfortunately still quite a few examples of decision makers, you know, making pretty outrageous decisions when it comes to refugee claims that are based on gender-based violence. And even, you know, maybe it's not just the final determination or the decision that's being made, but also the way that some of these proceedings take place. And, you know, I think about one example that received quite a bit of media attention, I think it was last year, where a woman had been, you know, very severely persecuted and experienced extreme violence at the hands of her her spouse. And during the line of questioning from the board member, who's, you know, sitting in front of this very vulnerable claimant, hearing her story around sexualized violence and domestic abuse, asked her why her husband hadn't just killed her, as if that was somehow to, you know, somehow to impugn her credibility or tell her, like, I do not believe you. You know, if it was as bad as you say, then your husband should have just killed you. So,
wow.
Yeah, just even like saying those things out loud makes me just think, you know, I can't even imagine you're, you know, these are people who are making probably the most important decision of many of these, you know, of this claimant's life, right? Who's fleeing this horrific persecution, and feeling as though, you know, she cannot go back to her country. She couldn't access protection in her country. And, you know, back to the question that we kind of talked about earlier, right? It could be for whatever reason, perhaps, you know, perhaps the sort of culture in that country, brings like huge huge disadvantages or whatever the case may be to even trying to access any kind of protection or social support in a situation where you're experiencing that kind of abuse. So, I mean, I think that although unfortunately it's not a single circumstance, I think that report did get the board's attention, the Immigration and Refugee Board's attention. And you know, I think from that, they have led quite an extensive review now of their guidelines and have asked for quite a bit of feedback with respect to what people who do this kind of work and those who've experienced the refugee determination process to just sort of contemplate what kinds of things need to be included in a particular guideline like that. And yeah, I mean, I think... It's unfortunate that I don't think that this situation is, again, specific or only happening in the context of our refugee determination system. You know, you also hear about situations of women who are reporting sexual assault or violence to the police in Canada and, you know, hearing these like horrifying stories of the way that that gets the way that that gets exposed and whether or not, you know, you feel as a survivor of that violence that you can even put that narrative forward and try to access any kind of justice, I think is really you know, another sort of part of our conversation with respect to access to justice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It reminds me of a case again in Manitoba just a handful of years ago where a young woman was chastised by the judge for wearing a too short a skirt. Right. And, you know, he was accusing her of asking to be raped because of the clothing choices that she had made. And this was the judge.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I know. I wish I could say I was surprised. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But it's, as you mentioned, it's so systemic. Mm-hmm. That it's kind of hard to recognize where those changes need to be, and is part of where the holes and the challenges are in coming up with some of these new ways and these new lenses.
Yeah. For sure. And I mean, I think like even in the context of refugee determination, it of course, you know, there are private proceedings. So I think, which they of course have to be considering the risk that, you know, people could face if their claims are denied and they are forced to return to their country. But I think, you know, it is another thing to contemplate in terms of that kind of analysis and that kind of questioning happening in a private proceeding. What happens when that claimant doesn't have counsel, for example, or is unrepresented, and facing that kind, you know, facing these sorts of questions or this sort of this kind of horrific re-traumatization in a refugee proceeding. So I'm encouraged that this review is happening. But I think, again, you know, the lens through which we're contemplating, I think, access to our refugee determination system, even the lens through which we contemplate access to our own criminal justice system, it is like inevitably has to have a gendered lens to it, considering the different impacts considering the different impacts, I guess, with respect to those who are accessing these systems.
Yeah. my last question for you, Amanda, is with the law being a very gendered profession as it is.
Indeed.
What does it mean to women and non-gender conforming folks to access the law and justice, and how are these reforms going to happen within the profession?
Yeah. Oh, that's a, yeah. That I think is a, I mean, of course, all the questions you've asked are important in this one. You know, I think about this a lot because, I was someone who very hesitantly went to law school and sort of dragged myself through it, knowing that what I wanted to do was gain another skill to be able to keep doing advocacy work with respect to migrant justice. I knew that that's what I kind of wanted to be able to, you know, help to keep doing in terms of my own work. But yeah, I think, in many ways, I was very privileged to be able to access law school, and many, many people, particularly, you know, those who come from families that aren't able to access financial resources to pay for law school. Like, I just think there's so many layers in terms of how we recruit those to be able to go to law schools, you know, the whole education system itself, who makes up the judiciary, who makes up decision-making bodies, and, you know, how still like white male they are, you know, like how, even though there are, you know, I know lots of lawyers who are women, trans practicing lawyers, I shouldn't say I know lots of trans practicing lawyers, but of course, you know, the more that I think the legal profession is representative of different genders, different backgrounds, and different kinds of folk to be more representative, I think, of our population, I think, you know, there will not be any kinds of, I think, systemic changes until we can see a more diverse legal profession, a more diverse makeup of judges and those making these decisions. Because ultimately, I mean, I think your example from that Manitoba judge is a really good one. I think most women find that like, it's just like that kind of comment where you're like, how could you ever come from that perspective, right? Blaming a woman for wearing a short skirt. And in the same way, I think without having the experiences of those who are most affected by the judicial systems and the administrative justice systems as well, it is really hard, I think, to push these issues forward and make sure that, you know, we are being as representative as possible. I think it's encouraging to me in the sort of immigration refugee bar that there does seem to be, you know, more and more diversity in terms of those with lived experiences pursuing this kind of area of law. But again, I think, you know, it sort of starts at the access to post-secondary education, access to the systems through which we train people to work in these areas. And ultimately, I mean, I think it's shaking up those systems themselves, right? Like we have had this sort of legal system that we rely on that was ultimately founded in a super racist colonialist fashion. And that's still our governing legal system. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of places to start shaking to see some real change.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I know that our hour is coming up to a close, and I want to just make sure that there's no stone left unturned, so to speak. And if there's something that you feel didn't get said in our conversation, or if there's something, just give you the last word.
I mean, I guess just to say thanks for hosting this conversation. It's as you can tell, I'm struggling even just to figure out where to put my energy in terms of thinking about where do we make the most change and how do we do that. But and I feel like I've been very pessimistic, but I guess I do want to say that I am encouraged by the incredible work being done by, you know, many legal professionals and community activists and those who are doing work on these issues. And I think there's room for more engagement. And I'm hopeful that Build Back After This COVID situation can involve more conversations about economic justice, you know, gender justice, migrant justice, and all of these, big themes that I think many of us want to see our governments taking action on.
And that ultimately come together and merge in the intersectionality that that you mentioned right off the top, because if you're in a lower socioeconomic bracket, then you're more likely to have, you know, interface with the law, not in a good way. And so these things all matter, right?
Exactly.
For people who are interested in maybe finding out more about these issues, do you have any suggestions for resources and follow up?
Mm-hmm. There are lots of amazing organizations that do work in these areas. I can think of, a couple in BC. West Coast Leaf, for example, is a legal advocacy organization that does work on gender equality. And I was looking actually at they have every year publish a gender equality report card. But I mean, I think they have tons of resources and encourage folks to get involved. The Migrant Workers Center, of course, also is another place that sort of talks about the particular vulnerabilities around migrant workers. I think there are the other association that I do some work with is the Canadian Association of Refugee Lawyers, from a more legal sort of background analysis around some of the issues that the organization is grappling with before the courts, and some advocacy with respect to refugee rights. But there's so many, I think, groups that are doing really important work in the country. So, I mean, those are a few. The Human Rights Commission, too. The new Human Rights Commission actually already has a few very interesting resources on their website with respect to just thinking about human rights in British Columbia. So that's another place I think people could for sure find out some more information about what's happening in the province.
Great. Yeah, thanks so much. Such an interesting conversation, and maybe we can follow up again another time when things change, get a little more optimistic.
Yeah.
But thanks so much. Amanda Aziz has been my guest today on Intravenous here on CJSF 90.1 FM. Thanks so much, and stay tuned. Democracy Now! Is coming up right after this.
Thanks for having me.
I won't ask if you could change. That's up to you. You can stay the same. Get along tonight.